Hello and welcome to the podcast of moreapologetics.com. We're glad you're here. I'm your host, Jonathan Pruitt. And as always at moreapologetics.com, our aim is to get you thinking about the moral argument because it has the ability to both illuminate the mind and stir the heart. On this week's episode, we have a very special treat in store. We actually get to step into the classroom with Dr. Brian Scalise. And we heard from Dr. Scalise a few weeks ago. He is an adjunct professor at Liberty University. He teaches New Testament Greek, and he recently was teaching an intensive to graduate students on Islam. Dr. Scalise also wrote his dissertation on the issues of love and Trinity and Tawhid in Islam. And if you recall, a few weeks ago, he explained in detail the difference between the Unitarian Islamic view and the Trinitarian Christian view and the implications for love. And I encourage you, if you haven't had the chance yet, to go listen to that first one before you listen to this one, because there's a lot of context that's set up that will help you understand what's going on here. But this week we're going to be returning to the topic again of the difference between love in Islam and Christianity. And in this lecture, Dr. Scalise carefully explains why the Christian Trinity provides an account of love that is richer and fuller than what is possible from an Islamic perspective. And so with all that in mind, we'll head right over to the classroom here and get to sit in Dr. Scalise's lecture. I hope you enjoy it.
So for our last segment of the class here, we're going to discuss love in Islam versus love in Christianity. The question you need to ask yourself is, how is it that we experience love on a day-to-day basis? So if you don't know that, or you haven't thought about that question, having a worldview that will help you kind of unpack it is essential for your understanding. Now, your average skeptic, or maybe atheist or agnostic or what have you, can love well. Nobody would deny that. We would all say we kind of intuitively know what it means to love. And we would kind of all say that I don't need to know the foundation from whence love comes to be able to actually love well. As Christians, though, we might want to ask the question of, but could we love better if we did understand the foundation? And I certainly think that we could, because it's going to bring clarity to what the inherent nature of love is. And too often we don't think about it. So we spent an immense amount of time in this class on the Trinity, especially in comparison with Allah and his Tawhid. So Siri had made a comment earlier where he was discussing Allah doesn't have anyone else. If we're talking about Allah before he created, eternity past, he has no one else. So how can you configure love on that model? It's possible, but it's going to look very different than what we think of when we think of love.
Would it be a self-love?
Probably. The best you could do is some sort of self-centered love. And when we say self-centered, don't imply narcissistic tendencies necessarily. We don't want to take that step, but we do want to say that there isn't anyone else to love. The only option before Allah creates is to love himself, if he can love anything. And remember that in Allah, there is no internal differentiation. There's nothing in him. He's not composite. In him, he's pure simplicity or tawhid. So there's no way for him to kind of love just a part of himself while loving, and then that part somehow loves him, and then it loves it back. That's all nonsense. Not to mention, I would point out, you would need persons to be able to do that. So it's only persons, according to what we understand, can love people, or can love at all for that matter. So let's take this step. So before we get to the Trinity, if you're going to practice Allah's love, if you're a Muslim, and just we're just doing imagination here. If you're a Muslim and you're thinking about, well, okay, Allah in eternity past, you're meditating on him, you think, oh, he loved himself. How will that affect, do you think, the way that you love?
generally, I think, gives you a good model for loving others.
Well, there is no others.
Yeah.
Right. So we as humans, though, we exist inherently as communal creatures. So how can that help me in that?
Here we are bringing up 2 points. Here you're bringing up 2 points. One is self-love and one is sharing love.
Mm.
So when God is one, in Quranic idea of Allah, God is one, He is Tawheed. And He has self-love because He is love. According to Quran, then how God, what God is one, can show His communal love when He creates man?
That's a very good question. How can somebody whose love has always been centered on himself, how can he now center it on man?
Exactly.
Excellent question. How could we work that out? There might be a way to do it, but it would require us to somehow make man always a means to Allah's self-love. Because he can't, remember, the love can't get shifted off of Allah. It's got to stay centered on him. Because that's, remember, that's the most primordial or original love, right? Self-love, Allah's self-love of himself, it has to reside there. You can't change. Because if you say, well, he's going to change it now and put it on creatures, now you're saying something essential to Allah has changed. That would be blasphemous. You can't say that. It's got to stay centered. So maybe, and we've explored this a little bit before, maybe creatures are just illusions. Maybe Allah can love them because they actually are him.
Then, Dr. Brand, what you're saying is when humans are illusion, then Allah's love is itself is illusion too.
Well, certainly the idea that Allah's love is actually loving someone else, that would be an illusion. You're right. How could that be real?
Because he is loving himself, because everyone is small gods or Allah's.
Mm-hmm.
But is Quran ever stated that humans are image of Allah?
No.
Then how can we say that humans are small, Allahs are there,
yeah,
or small gods, or whatever it is? I may not be having a right word.
Yeah, no.
Then when man is, or human, are not the image of God, when they are not Allah. Because according to Bible, and we all believe that we are an image of God. So, we are representing some godliness, even though we are sinners, we are representing some godliness. So, in that sense, we are sharing God's love with one another, and we are loving God with that love. Here, in Quranic idea, when God is one, and rest of is illusion, there is no such thing raises and decreases, that there is no human, and he is loving he himself. And but it is not reality still, right?
It's not really, right.
Because there is a human, he is not illusion.
Well, that's the question, right? So if we were to consult Al-Ghazali, like we've discussed, he would suggest that really everything is one. He would suggest that this world is either an illusion or an emanation. But Siri, I think you're bringing up a good point, because there seems to be something really contradictory about the idea that, you know, I'm an illusion, or that you're an illusion. Because for my critical faculties, for my mind-body experience, for all purposes, it seems very real to me that I am a other. I am someone. I'm not just an illusion. So could we, though, so let's kind of take this a different route. Let's go, let's say, remember we talked about Ibn Taymiyyah and his view that maybe creation is truly contingent somehow and really we really are others. If that's true, can Allah kind of invite us into his loving of himself? Can he kind of share, can he love us as an end in ourselves? I would probably say no. Because remember, he can't change with creation. He loves himself. That's the only type of love he has available to himself before he creates. But is there a way that maybe he could help humans participate in his loving of himself?
This is probably a great place to draw a distinction. The highest commands for the Christian is to love the Lord your God with your heart, soul, mind, strength. And the second is like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. The Quran does enjoin or command believers to be kind and deal with one another with kindness and mercy and so forth. But the ultimate command in Islam is about submission. And we were reading the Quran earlier and we kept coming across texts that say, and we are Muslims, or we are those who submit to Allah. And the ultimate command then is to come into that right slaveship with Allah. Whereas if we were going to draw a nice distinction, we might say the ultimate command for Christians based on this idea of love is to come into right friendship with God. So maybe we could draw that distinction if that's fair.
Okay, Dr. Brian, you're saying is right, but before that you said, in Allah's view, or according to Quran, whatever it is, humans are illusion. How come a God gives commands to an illusionary man? Let's say, I can command my own shadow, can I?
That's
Sri Shadow, go away from here. He doesn't go.
That's good.
So how can God, who is above everything, and He's one, Tawheed, He can command, which is illusion? My first question. Second question is, when God is treating humans as a slaves, how can a master show His love to slaves? What kind of love we can derive from Quran itself?
Sure.
All right, so the first question I don't have an answer to because I think you're hitting an inconsistency. I think you've just highlighted the inconsistency. If we are illusions and Allah is giving illusions commands that are actually Him, how does that make any sense? Because it's just part of me. I don't command myself to do things. I just do things. I don't need a command. Commands seem to imply that there's someone outside of me. So yeah, I think you're just hitting if we agree with Al-Khazali or Ibn Arabi that everything is Allah, everything's pantheistic or emanational, it doesn't make sense. Why are there commands then? If everything is you, just have it done the way you want to do it because it's you. So that's great, and you're pointing out inconsistency. The second question would be, if we are in slaveship to Allah and He's commanding us to be in that relationship to Him, how can love exist?
Yeah,
I don't know that it, on the illusionary, obviously it doesn't even exist then because really He's just loving Himself. But let's imagine for a moment that it's really contingent. Creatures are really contingent and really true others. So in that case, it seems to be that the best, from my understanding of Islam and the Quran and the fact that Ibn Taymiyyah is going to say that you can't make Allah's love centered on creatures because to do so would be to change how Allah loves. Because in eternity past, He's loving Himself. The best we can do is say that Allah extends a hand to us to welcome us into loving Him.
So therefore, you're saying is Allah has to be reached to the human being and say,
love me.
Love me.
Love me.
That's the only way Allah can say, this is my love.
Right. He doesn't love them in the sense that His love centers on them, because that would be a violation of His pure Tawhidic love of Himself. But He could invite us into loving Him, which God in the Bible tells us to love Him, but we understand it as reciprocal. He loves us and we love Him. But in the Quran, if Allah's love is essentially a self-centered love, and we'll get to the Trinity here in a minute to make that contrast. But if His love is essentially a self-centered love, then that can't change when He creates. So maybe the good way to think about this would be like a whirlwind. So it's like His whirlwind is in Himself here. He loves Himself, loves Himself, loves Himself, loves Himself. And then when He creates, though, now His love extends out to say, creatures, come love me. And so they all just participate in that. And that would probably be the best I think you could do. What do you say to that?
There is no disrespect here, but I'm not comparing anyone to anyone. But let's say, if this is the same case with a human, what do you say? What kind of love is it?
Well, yeah, that's... we wouldn't like, or we probably wouldn't enjoy a relationship with a human that didn't love us but always expected us to love them. We probably wouldn't enjoy that relationship.
I thought so.
Yeah. And we could say narcissism here, at least with humans. We'll be careful not to apply that to Allah. But with humans, if we know someone that's all about loving themselves and they basically want to invite people into loving them, we would say this person is a narcissist. Right? They're not actually loving the people, but they're saying, hey, come love me. I'd say, you need some help. Will probably be my response.
No, I'm not comparing ourselves with Allah, because no one can compare with God. Hmm. But our ethics and morality is completely derived and based on what our holy book says, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then, when my God is saying love, about love, in one way, and expecting me to do in another way, how can I follow that?
Excellent observation. That is right, by the way. And we want to give kudos here, or just recognize that the Quran does say, hey, creatures, deal kindly, do good to one another, which is kind of another way of saying love one another, just to let you know. I mean, doing good to others is kind of an expression of love. But the Quran does say that, but it's in kind of contradiction to what Allah does in himself. So you're right. It would seem to be the case that the Quran is supposed to be Allah's speech, his eternal speech. But if it's his eternal speech, how can it tell creatures to act in a different way than he himself acts? We would expect him to be consistent. And so, sure, that's a good ethical point, that inconsistency. So let's transition. So we've kind of unpacked that, kind of explored some issues with love on Islam. Let's kind of contrast that now with the Trinity. The Trinity is, you know, earlier we were talking about how you have to keep the ontological priority of the persons and the nature. Both of those are equally weighty, equally important. This is so because for love to exist, what has to exist? According to our everyday life, other people. There's got to be somebody else to love. And I think most of us intuitionally know that. I think we'd say, yes, the second greatest command does say love your neighbor as yourself. It implies that you know how to love yourself. But I think most of us would experience really wonderful and soaring heights of enjoyment when we're with our family, friends, community in the best of situations, where we're really experiencing love in deep, profound ways. But it always implies more than one. There's got to be someone else there. So this is where I think the doctrine of the Trinity outshines this idea of Allah being alone. It's because you have these three persons that have continually had one another relationships always and forever, and they're sharing in community perpetually. So basically, and let's kind of lay this out real plainly. Love, from my understanding, requires two things. You got to have other people or others, and there has to be unity or community. And these are the exact things that the Trinity gives us. It gives us, with God's nature, their unity or the place of their community, and it gives us with the persons their otherness, and also points to how they can be a community. If you don't have others, you can't have a community. If you don't have unity, how can you have love? And so I just think the Trinity is a wonderful explanation for our day-to-day life experience of love and community. By the way, what do we creatures do, since you were talking about the ethical or moral consistency? Really, all we're doing is mimicking what God does in himself, then. God the Father loves the Son, who loves the Spirit, and the Spirit loves the Son and the Father, and so they're loving one another. And so God says, love one another. Not asking us to do anything but what he does himself. It's just all we are is representative of that.
And then, obviously, God is loving God in some sense in the Trinity, right? God the Father loves God the Son. God the Son loves God the Spirit. And so when he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, again, is he asking us to do anything different from what he does? No. He's inviting us into the very same thing he's already doing. So it basically, creation just looks like a form, a place for God to welcome us into the very thing he does and give expression to what he does in us humans, and we do it by representing that. That's probably as simple and as clear-cut as I can make it. Questions? This is important because the Trinity itself is such a esoteric doctrine. It's kind of out there, like we've talked about, but when it comes to love, if you don't have an image of God, some sort of idea of God that allows for community and otherness, or unity and otherness, I don't see how you can explain the deepest levels of human love that we experience on a daily basis.
Isn't this wonderful, Dr. Brandt? He, as a Trinity God, one loves another one, and to share that love, they created man in their own image.
Mm.
And when man did sin, and he himself came down to restore his image back with love. Like, and even John 3:16 says, he so loved the world. Like, and there is a love in Trinity, and he, with love he created, and there is a love in the universe too. That's so, that makes some sense.
Sure, so it's kind of a step there. It makes sense. Oh, God is a being that essentially is about loving others, because that's what he does in himself. So whenever we see, oh, the world falls, the image is kind of, the image falls, well, there's a sense in which God says, I'm an outpouring type of God. I go and I rescue, I restore, I love. Yeah, and so, yeah, that step isn't hard to take. Jeff, do you have something?
Yeah, I was going to say, as I think about some of the things that we do know about his love from the Bible, we can mirror those things, so there's not far-fetched, or we're not striving to do something that we're not able to do, like his faithfulness, like you just mentioned a few, or maybe his forgiving love, or his sacrificial love, Romans 5.
Mm-hmm.
We can all do those to some degree, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like Sri's saying, there's a problem if Allah is not an example. He's telling you what to do, but he can't be that example, too. God can tell us what to do, invite us in, but also be an example for how to do it by what he's done.
That's excellent. Excellent summary. That seems to be right. I'll come right to you next. Seems to be right, though, that not only do we know what to do, commands, but we have a moral, ethical foundation in God's nature and who he is as the persons for that. So we can give explanation to this. And through that, maybe even be a little bit more clearer on how to love well.
Sir?
Dr. Brandt, if I'm citing right, we just gone through Surah 9, 4 to 30.
We did.
There says, they commands to kill someone.
To fight and strive against those who are disbelievers.
Can you compare that one with the Quranic idea of loving, and the Old Testament God of love, like, because he gives the same command sometimes in Old Testament.
Sure.
Kill someone.
Yeah.
So can you compare Allah's love and Old Testament God of love?
Yeah, so I think this is probably one of the most challenging questions that in the world today we really face, because the genocides. And remember that, you know, when the Israelites go into the promised land, they kill everybody. They even kill all the way down to the animals. It is interesting, though, firstly, to note that the fact that before the Israelites show up, there are statements in the Old Testament that talk about the sin of the Canaanites filling up, the cup of their wrath filling up. So there's a sense in which we shouldn't come at the text and just look like God's just saying, well, they disbelieve in me, therefore they don't believe this religion, therefore kill them. That's not that the command is dealing with this culture, whatever their sins are. We know that they were sacrificing their children and various other evils. But whatever other sins they have, God is kind of tallying these up until a judgment day.
So it's not about like, oh, they just don't believe in Yahweh, which is what we find, you know, Surah 9 is about. It jumps around, but it's kind of like, here's this defensive war, but also the disbelievers might not be faithful, therefore fight with them. And basically it says of Christians specifically, I think it's 9:29, to humble them, to humiliate them, to bring them low until we're forced to pay the zakat or the forced tithe. So it seems to me, now I'm not saying that totally answers the question. I would note, though, that also, I think sometimes this gets overlooked, Yahweh's original command was about driving the people out. It wasn't about killing them. Now, that doesn't answer, I'm not saying that gives us a clear answer. I still think that we have those moral difficulties with how could God do this. But I think one of the biggest differences, in Surah 9, it's about becoming part of their religion. Old Testament, it's about paying for their sins. So I think that'd probably be the best I could do. That's a good question. It's a good question. So let's talk a little bit about St. Augustine's formula. We mentioned it earlier in the class. Let's come back to it. Now, I've done this before, but I think it's significant because a Muslim thinker from the 9th century, I think it's Al-Dalami, he actually uses St. Augustine's formula to describe Allah. So it's a fascinating move because St. Augustine says that God is lover, beloved, and love. Now, how does St. Augustine work that out? He works it out by saying the Father is the lover, the Son is the beloved, like we see in Matthew 3, this is my beloved Son, and that the Spirit is the love. And that's why you see the Father, the lover, says, this is my beloved Son, and what is the expression of that love but the descent of the Spirit in the form of a dove? And so you have this wonderful image at the baptism of Jesus of kind of this Trinitarian reality of these three things. Now, Al-Dalami is going to take that and he's going to apply it to Allah. Now, remember, if we apply it to Allah, it has to be a self-centered love. It has to be a love that remains centered on Him. And there are no internal persons to Allah. He's not Father, Son, and Spirit. He's just Allah. Which Seth, I think you said you called it a monad earlier, which is probably pretty accurate. I think that's right. You have this idea of like a Trinitarian monotheism versus a monadic or Unitarian monotheism. So Allah is the lover of the beloved, which is Allah, and He's the love as well. So Allah is the lover, He loves Himself, and the activity of that love is Himself. So it's Allah, 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 or Allah cubed, maybe we could say. The point is, though, is that something really, I don't know if disturbing is the right word, but unhelpful occurs here. Because you kind of look at this Trinitarian formula, and it really resonates with us. Like, oh, look at a family. A father, a mother, and a child. Well, there's this kind of like the father loves the mother loves the father, and then the child comes along, and now you have these three people, and we can all get that, like, hey, as a husband, I love my wife, and soon I'm going to have a daughter. The two of us will love her, and she will be kind of an expression of our love. So this really resonates with us as communal creatures, right? As family creatures. All of us have families. This resonates with us, but then all of a sudden you say, okay, let's apply that to a singular person. I don't know. It almost scares me. If I focused on myself that much, I would be scared what would happen to me. In some sense. And I don't say that to be crass. I can't imagine, like, I'm going to love myself. I'm going to be the lover, and I love myself, and all my energy goes into loving my... That doesn't help me understand my human experience very well.
There's a degree, I think, to which we understand God creating us for us to know Him and so that He can receive glory back from us experiencing life like He wanted to. But it seems like this love goes far beyond that. Whereas we would say God's not selfish to be jealous for our attention or affection because He's the one deserving of it. But that type of self-centeredness seems like it's going far beyond that for this love. in Allah.
Yeah, and that seems right. There's a sense in which
God is partly justified, if he's God, of being a little bit, you know, centered on himself because he's perfect, holy. But love seems to need something else besides him.
I think so. Yeah, there's got to be some measure of reciprocity. If it's just about self, self, and self, I think most of us are going to start to feel like, I don't know how that's really a fullness of love, right? You're going to kind of say, if it's just about self, self, and self, it's just all about me, me, me. I think most of us are going to get a little uncomfortable with that. Is that really a full picture of love? Intuitionally, we're kind of saying, I'm not so sure. And Jeff's probably right here. So is Allah worthy of worship and having attention drawn to him? Absolutely. Well, similarly, we would say the same thing about God and Christianity. Is he worthy of that? Sure. In some sense, in Christianity, God's self-centeredness is our salvation. Draw as much attention to the cross as you can, God, because if you don't, we're all going to perish. I mean, seriously, just to kind of really draw the implications of that out. If God doesn't draw attention to himself, it's the worst for us. It's the worst for us. But don't miss this either. Jesus Christ's death on the cross is the outpouring glory and love of God for us. It's our recognition, both of it as glory and as love, I think, that in some sense engenders love from us. We kind of enjoy that amazing, sacrificial, outpouring love. God so loved the world that he gave. Love, by the way, just if you want a real simple definition, has as its at its core the notion of giving. You can't remove giving from love without it ceasing to be love. Of course, in Islam, you might have to, because the best you could do is say Allah gives to himself, right? In eternity past, there's no giving to others, clearly. Just who could be the object of his love but himself? There isn't anyone else.
Okay, Dr. Brian, what you're saying is agreeable. Okay, let's say we agree what you're saying. But then how Quran deals with the idea of hell when Allah is the center of his own love? Who is going to hell now?
Do you want to think of the world as illusory or as contingent?
No, I don't understand right now. Because when Allah is center of his love and he is loving himself and he is expecting love from others, let's say he himself is expecting love because he's the one, then who is going to help?
Well, definitely, if the world is an illusion, nobody, in some sense, because how could they? But that would be inconsistent with their holy book.
Yeah.
So
somebody's going to hell, though.
Right. Somebody's. So if the world's really contingent, now I know it seems like such a mess, but look, they don't. Their God world relationship isn't structured like. I mean, ours is really clear. God creates ex nihilo. We are contingent creatures. Is some theologians say that in Islam? Some of their most prominent theologians say the world's illusory, so we kind of got to jump around here. But the world's contingent. Anyone that doesn't recognize Allah as the center of their life and give their undevoted love to him, perhaps go to hell, on their view. Right? I mean, we just got done reading a number of surahs that discuss how us unbelievers who associate Jesus with Allah or worship him, that we are... we're committing shirk, and we're deserving of damnation. So I think that it has to do about this recognition of God's centrality. Now, notice here that our language here is very Christian in some sense. If you listen to somebody, some pretty famous pastors out there, they talk about the centrality of God in your life a lot. So notice here, this isn't totally foreign to Christianity, but you need to recognize that Allah is the center of your life and that your love needs to go to him. But it's not necessarily about, and remember this, receiving love from Allah, especially because he can't center it on you. But secondly, we mentioned before, the whole idea of the father-child relationship doesn't hold in Islam.
That's a Christian idea. Don't put that on Muslims. The relationship there is master-slave. And you need to recognize that's the relationship. And I guess that's how, I guess that's how that relationship functions. But see, the thing, I think a Muslim would rejoice in it. I don't think, like, to our ear, it might sound bad. To their ear, yeah, you need to recognize your slavehood and rejoice in it and love Allah. And if you don't, you're going to go to hell. So does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Kate, you got anything? Any questions? No? maybe we should take a moment here. Let's talk about fatherhood a little bit, simply because it's so central to the idea of love. And if we want to extend that, make sure that we're egalitarian, we might say parenthood. Can somebody, Jeff, can you flip to Ephesians? I'm going to say it's 2:14 or 15, but it talks about the fatherhood of God. Let me know when you get there.
Verse I have in mind, which I'll just kind of tell you about it. If I could get one of you guys to keep kind of looking for that in chapter, it's either in chapter 2 of Ephesians or chapter 4. It deals with, it says that the fatherhood, that every father is named, every father on earth is named after the fatherhood of God. Now, this is a really significant verse because usually we think of in the opposite direction. We usually think, like, we humans came up with the idea of fatherhood, and then we use that as a helpful idea and apply it to God. Now, it's true that we have to understand fatherhood. We talked about this yesterday in our epistemology section, but we have to understand fatherhood from our earthly experience, and then it helps us understand the fatherhood in heaven. You got it? Speak up.
For this reason, I kneel before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth is named.
Okay. Very important. Because this verse makes it, this is one of the very few places where we get a divine name that we know isn't based on creation. There might be other of them, but this one makes it really clear that God's fathership is one of the truest things about him. Because all families on earth are families because it's designed to, they're designed to express that. Now, that very, now notice that's very different. So, I mean, we could come up with a lot of analogies just from our human experience and say, yeah, this kind of describes God. But this is one from Scripture that clearly says God's fatherhood is why there's families. Why do families exist in the way they do? God's father, which, by the way, this should resonate with our thinking already because we've explored a lot of the idea. So in Genesis 1, 26 through 28, Genesis 2, 24, where the human family and their sexuality specifically is designed to be the image of God. So it shouldn't be something strange. Now, with that said, notice that this is God. I told you guys before, there's multiple senses for the word father in the Bible. So number one, is God the father of creation in the sense that he's the creator? You say,
yeah.
We would say yes to that, no doubt. So that's kind of like how the whole Godhead or all three person, like all of God is the father of creation in that sense. But within God himself, you have the God the Father, who is the, in historic theology, unoriginate God. And the Son is the begotten God, and the Spirit is the proceeding God. So we have fatherhood in that sense. And then I told you likewise, there's human fatherhood. All right, so there's our third meaning. Now, human fatherhood, you got to recognize, is always a degenerate's the right word, maybe a deprived version of fatherhood because we're fallen and limited. So I hope to be a wonderful father. I do. But there's some sense in which my fatherhood always has to point beyond itself. Because the fatherhood of God is the point of family. Like this love, this intimacy, this unity is designed to point to our unity with God, our love with God. By the way, each of you, I don't know if we could just kind of go around here. When you think of
loved your parents. Well, like, just think of a word that it describes. Like what pops in you when you think, my relationship with my parents, assuming it's good. What word pops into your head? Jeff, you want to start? We'll kind of go this way.
Care.
Care? All right, that's a great word. Care?
Trust.
Trust?
Giver?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Support?
Support? That's good, which kind of goes with the idea of care and giving. I think of enjoyment, so I'll come back to you. I think of it, for some reason, I think of enjoyment as an important one that pops to my head.
Pursuit?
Them pursuing you? Or you pursuing them? Or both?
At least from my experience, it's me trying to pursue my dad so that he will know Christ.
Okay, so. Sure. So it's kind of this, like, unending care. Yeah. It's kind of this, like, endurance for their good. Might be a great way to say that.
Protection.
All right, that's probably good. So here's what I'm trying to get at. So if we, as Christians, does the Bible tell us to speak about God as Father?
Yes.
Yeah, so we have Jesus' example. He clearly called God Father, but we also have a number of places in the New Testament, Romans and Galatians pop to my mind, where we call Father, not just Father, but we call him Abba, which Abba is kind of, it's a really intimate term. It isn't the more formal word for Father. It's kind of like Daddy. It's this, like, little child. So if you've ever, like, I have a niece and nephew, you know, and they call my, you know, Daddy. And the child is so trusting, knows that the parents care, that, you know, that the child just runs to them in trust and hope and knows that he or she is loved. Yes?
I was just going to say the same thing. Like, when I was in Israel, one of the coolest things being in Israel was hearing, like, this little, like, so young kid, maybe like toddler, just calling her father Abba.
Oh, yeah?
Because it's just like, you see the just complete dependency from the child to her dad.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So with that being said, there's a sense in which it's almost kind of sad for Muslims that they are, I don't know if robbed's the right word, but they don't have that imagery underlying their relationship with God. Think about that. I mean, just everything we just laid out, think about how robust and wonderful a picture that is. Think about this little child calling out Abba, reaching up, grabbing their dad, trusting him, knows that the dad's going to give, knows that you can be intimate, know that you don't have to be scared, that you can come to him. I mean, these are all really fantastic just experiences that we have in human life. Sometimes we take them for granted, but they're incredible. And then the Muslim's going to say, no, God's not our Father. He's our Lord, which to them, I'm no doubt, has some measure of intimacy to it. I'm just trying to draw out the fact that I can't see how that could ever have the type of intimacy that the father-child relation entails. I just don't see how that's possible. And so when we're having discussion with Muslims and this is something to spend some time on. You can come to know God in an intimate fashion. He is the prodigal father. He's the father that runs for you with like exuberance. That's the idea of prodigal, means this idea of like overspending or lavish. The prodigal father runs out lavishly to the son who returns home, right? The prodigal son comes home. So he runs out. He embraces him. You can come to him. He's going to receive you back as a son. I think that's a wonderful image. And we have this by virtue of our belief in Jesus Christ. Should we trust him?
Thank you, Dr. Brandon Scalise, for that very insightful lecture. Also enjoyed the comments from the students. It was a real pleasure to be able to hear that discussion going on. And big news over at moralapologetics.com. We just announced the winners of the 2015 writing contest. So head on over to the site and you can see who those are. And their essays will be coming up shortly on the site. Thanks to everyone who participated. We really enjoyed reading your essays. And as always, I want to remind you that we have content going up several times a week at the site from a wide array of disciplines, including philosophy, biblical studies, poets, literary scholars, just something for everyone, and something that I'm sure that you'll find useful. So thanks again for listening, and we hope to have you back again next week for another podcast with moralapologetics.com.